You're with that.
We don't do our
okay.
best.
All right, very good. Ready? House Committee on Education will come to order. It's Wednesday, February 19th. Colleagues, thank you for coming today. We have two bills and a great informational hearing. And as usual, today will be interesting and fun. So we are not going in order. I know that many of you are here for Senate Bill 1538, which we will get to at about 2 o'clock this afternoon. We're going to start with Senator Close and Senate Bill 1574. Then we're going to go into the informational hearing. And then around 2 o'clock or maybe a little bit thereafter, we will get to Senate Bill 1538. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1574. Richard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1574A clarifies that standards for dual credit programs must establish a manner by which students in grades 9 through 12 may earn course credit for both high school and community college courses or public university courses.
Thank you very much. And Senator Close, welcome.
Well, thank you, Chair Gelser, and members of the House Committee on Education. I am Senator Betsy Close, and I really appreciate that you're hearing this bill today. As you all know, important work is being done to redesign the connection between high school and post-secondary education. This bill is very simple. It will help move forward an important component of the redesign. It will allow students easier and earlier access to classes that can count towards college. Many students do not see college as an option. Allowing freshmen and sophomores the opportunity to receive college credit, which they currently cannot, hopefully helps some students change their mind and view advanced learning as more attainable. It will also help highly motivated students who have more options. The research continues to point to the fact that accelerating the access of college credit is a key component for both high school and college graduation. So Senate Bill 1574A will clarify in the statute that grades 9 through 12 can pursue college credit in high school. It's a good bill that I think will help our youth, and I ask for your support on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And are there any questions for Senator Close? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I'm on the Accelerated Learning Task Force, which is looking at this. How does this dovetail with the work we're doing?
Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, I would guess that it would go in concert with the work that you're doing. It's a very small change in statute, but I think it would make a big difference, and I would hope that your group would be in favor of it.
Thank you.
I should make one comment. I did try to check on the fiscal if there would be cost to the community colleges or colleges for doing this, and it looks like I've heard from Doug Wilson that it's minimal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for Senator Close? And just a clarification, this is strengthening the idea that students can earn, like I know my daughter last year got a couple of credits through Lynn Bentney Community College as a freshman. Is this just making it very clear for every district that they can do that?
That's, Chair Gelser, that is correct in my view. Right now the statute doesn't specify the grades that can take advantage of this, so the community colleges, by rule, can exclude certain students. So this just clarifies that.
Great. Thank you very much. Last call. Any further questions for Senator Close? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Tim Cowan. And not Mark, are you here? But you want to testify on the other bill, not this one, right?
Right.
Okay. I didn't want to miss you. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Tim Cowan. I'm a private citizen. And what I wanted to do is tell you about an exciting program that might just interface with us very well.
Okay.
Okay. First of all, SouthlakeChurch.com entered into a partnership with St. John's, Roosevelt High School, and the Portland School District. We, as a result, have the largest graduation rate increase in the state of Oregon as a result of that partnership. They have the newest, most complete athletic facility in Portland. Failing athletic teams are now in the playoffs. If you'll notice in the back of the brochure, Neil Lomax, I think, had something to do with it. It was scheduled for closure, and now it's going to be renovated. There was over $3 million in benefits to the school. We had cleanup days, athletic facilities, computers, food, donations, and we contributed $230,000, but we have no public money. We're going to, we're in the process of expanding this program. We're going nationally. There's a program in Washington, D.C. We think our goal and objective by 2016-2017 is 20,000 schools across the country and 10 million kids served. So if the school district or the Department of Education wants to tie in with what 1574 is designed to do, this type of a program may help that school district get the kids, improve the graduation rates, and get them better prepared for college.
So that sounds like a really exciting program. Can you help me understand what the connection is to the dual credits through the community college and this program?
I think what we'll do is we'll get so many more kids because of the highest graduation rate that that school has the facilities and so on to get those college credits and just implement that in the school program.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Are there questions for Mr. Cowan? Seeing none? Thank you both
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we don't have everybody here, but we have a quorum, yes?
2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Are we comfortable moving this bill? Yeah? Okay, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House on Senate Bill 1574 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1574. Representative Springer.
Madam Chair, I move that I make a motion that we move Senate Bill 1574A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Did I get it right?
You did. Very, very good. Representative Springer moves Senate Bill 1574A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No, I would just thank you for bringing this bill. The importance of kids being able to access college credit through the dual credit program is so important. And I think one of the things that's exciting about these programs is it's not just the AP and the IB classes. Kids are able to get college credit for childcare and culinary arts and welding. So you're really attaching kids to thinking about college and post-secondary education in a whole variety of ways. And I think that's part of our 40-40-20 is looking not just at four-year degrees, but at career certificates and professional certificates and two-year degrees. So this is a great bill. With that, would you please call the roll, Debbie?
Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Gomber?
Excused.
Representative Gorsuch?
Excused.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Wisman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rearson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Gelser?
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes. Senator Close, is there a House sponsor that you would want to carry this?
I would be pleased if you would carry it.
I would be happy to carry it. So I'll carry this, and the motion passes, and the bill goes to the floor. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1574. And I will open an information hearing on students with significant behavior needs. So we have a large panel of people today on pink sheets that are here today on the second sheet. So there's a group of folks that's called the Professional Committee that has been meeting for the last several months under the leadership of Stacy Sibley at the Willamette ESD. And they have been looking at the needs of students who have some pretty significant behavior needs. I had the chance to meet with them after we've worked on a number of bills here related to some of these classrooms, including seclusion and restraints and the seclusion cells last session and our disparate discipline policy, which we're going to hear about more on Friday. And these folks have been working very hard to put together a presentation so we can start to think more about these students, how we might better meet their needs in the state of Oregon, prepare them to graduate from high school, and maybe look at putting together a work group in the interim. But we just wanted to get a good introduction today to who these kids are and what the issues are. So I'll start. I generally call people up in groups of three. Is that And if I call you up in different ways, just re-scramble yourselves. But starting with Stacy Sibley, Jordan Spikes, and Jan Lacey. But if you prefer to come in a different panel, that's fine.
Is
Thank you, Madam Chair, co-chairs, and members of the committee.
We have a short video that's going to show briefly about a minute, and then if it's okay, I'll start talking at that point.
Sounds great. And we have until about 2 o'clock. Does that work?
I will remember you. Will you remember me? Don't let your
continue to play behind me while I'm speaking. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, co-chairs, and member of the committee. For the record, my name is Stacey Sibley from the Willamette ESD. I'm the special ed director. After the shootings a year ago at Sandy Hook, I wrote to colleagues and asked them if we could come together to talk about students with challenging behaviors. I didn't want to wait until another tragedy happened. This video shows 10 years of students who were shot on campus, and that's what this is. Since the tragedy at Sandy Hook, there's been 44 additional school shootings. This group has looked at over the last year students who have challenging behaviors. These are the students in schools that really stretch our resources. These are the students that are being suspended, expelled, restrained, secluded, sent to behavior programs, sent to behavior schools, and who are not graduating from our programs. With only 42% of our special ed students graduating in the state of Oregon, that's 58 out of every 100 dropping out. We really felt that this is an emergency. I wanted to give you a little bit of information about our committee. We have about 40 members from all over the state working in Department of Human Services, foster care, Oregon Youth Authority, education, special education, psychiatry. So we have a really good representative who are looking at ways to work with this population in schools and in outside agencies. We have a 35% above the national rate in suicide, so we're looking at student self-esteem also. I wanted to tell you a brief story about a student that I worked with about 6 years ago. I was the principal at Pioneer School in Portland, which is a school for students with special ed behavioral needs. And I had a 5-year-old student come to me named Bobby, who was not yet special ed eligible. And when he came to me, he had been kicked out of the elementary school and needed to be evaluated for special ed. He, at that point, could not string 5 words together. He had been in the hospital and been highly medicated. When he came to me, he had 13 different medications that he was on. He was identified as early onset schizophrenia. The family was told he would probably be in an institution by the time he was 10 years old. We had a very staff-enriched program. And it was a high staff-to-student ratio, and I still felt Bobby was not going to be able to function within my classrooms at Pioneer. So I immediately handpicked 2 therapeutic coaches to work with him outside the classroom. We were lucky at the time. We were using a new methodology called collaborative problem solving, which didn't look at any of the shame and blame programs that are often used with this population. It looked at kids having a lack of skill, not a lack of will. And so with that in mind, we went ahead and worked with the student for quite a while. By the end of the first year, Bobby was able to go integrate into our special ed classrooms at Pioneer, and with a little extra support, able to stay in the classrooms. He was very aggressive. He would run away. He ended up, before going into the classroom, being restrained and secluded, often hurting staff, hurting himself. When I left Pioneer, he was doing very well inside the classroom, and I heard about a year later that he was fully included in a typical public school with behavior classroom support.
Well, I'm telling you the story because about a week ago I spoke to Bobby to see if he could come and talk here because I heard how well he was doing. I had not seen or talked to him in about four and a half years. And when I saw him, I was amazed because standing before me, honestly, in my 34 years of doing this, I've never seen anything like this. He was a typical 13-year-old student at grade level, funny, great sense of humor, insightful, and able to carry on a great conversation and tell me what was going on in his life. He really wanted to be here today, but because of the stigma associated with these disabilities and how well he was doing, his family thought it would be better if he did not come. But he did write to me later and said, you know, can I send you a letter to read because I do want to help other kids. And what something that's important to note with Bobby, he had no therapies. He was off all medication. And you know, he said the only thing that happened that he had good teachers and a good family and people who were willing to take the time and develop relationships with him and teach him the skills and had good feelings about those programs that he was in. So, Bobby, I'm just going to read his brief letter. Dear Madam Chair, co-chairs, and members of the committee, I'm sorry I can't be with you today. I want to share my history with you so I can help other children. As Stacy said, I was having some troubles in kindergarten. I was having a stressful time because the work was too hard for me. I had a lot of fine motor problems, and I got in trouble and went to the principal's office. My troubles kept progressing and progressing until I started holding my breath in school and ended up so bad that I got into the hospital. They did tests on my brain and put me on a lot of medication. I ended up in school for special education where I was restrained by the teachers because my behavior was dangerous and I had a lot of problems. I was one of the worst kids, and I needed two private teachers for a while. It was real bad. The teachers really helped me in my progress, and slowly I got better. Through the loving care of my parents and my teachers, and through the resources that were available, I was able to mainstream in school. I was in a special ed class there, and eventually I did well and went to full mainstream. Then in sixth grade middle school, I was full-time mainstream, and I think they were putting a lot of work stress on me. There wasn't enough support. I was doing 3 hours of homework a night with a tutor. I did terrible because of the workload, and I feel the problem nowadays with public schools that it's all sink or swim. Even some of the top children don't do that well. The material was quite strenuous, and I felt that mainstream teachers were not as compassionate and caring. Although I didn't do well, I still wanted to stay because the special ed teachers were really nice. Then eventually my parents were worried and pulled me out, and currently I go to a private school where I'm doing well. I'm on the cross-country team, I play violin, I learn German and Spanish, and I do fencing after school. I'm keeping up with my peers, and I don't have any therapy or medication. That's from Bobby. And I really did want him to be here today because I look at it, this as a miracle. I did think if this was a student that I'd probably go visiting in some kind of state institution. And he's doing so well. So our hope here today is with the information that we give you that we can have Bobby's story happen for all of our kids. I would like to introduce Jordan Spikes.
Madam Chair, co-chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jordan Spikes. I'm a lead therapeutic intervention coach of the Willamette ESD. I am also a master level instructor of nonviolent crisis intervention for the Crisis Prevention Institute. Recent acts of violence and Oregon's increasing focus on student performance and achievement have shone the spotlight on students with challenging behaviors and mental health concerns. We have gathered from around the state as a group of concerned professionals feeling the urgency to address these issues in order to decrease the violence in schools and reduce the numbers of suspensions, expulsions, restraints, and seclusions resulting from these challenging behaviors. Over a series of committee meetings, we discussed an evolving set of best practices for working with students at every level of functioning. We hope to continue networking with other professionals statewide in order to best care for these students and to teach them the skills necessary to function appropriately within our schools and within society at large. As a committee with a diverse set of expertise, we are equipped to make recommendations to groups who work with these sometimes challenging children and adolescents from prenatal to age 21 using a common language that ensures consistent support through contemporary research. It is our hope that this presentation is the first step in that direction. Now I would like to introduce Jan Lacey.
Great, thank you. And if the next two people who are after Jan want to come on up at the same time, that's fine too.
We're coming in pairs.
You're coming in pairs, all right.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chair Gensler, co-chairs, and members of the committee. Thank you for having us today. My name is Jan Lacey, and I'm a care coordinator for wraparound programs in Yamhill County. We serve children and youth with intensive mental health needs. The reason I have that job today, though, is because I am a mother of a youth who had mental health challenges, and at 16 years old, I wondered what in the world is going on with this child's brain. I knew it was something we, as his parents, had never seen before, and I immediately jumped into advocating, and that's what I've been asked to talk about a little bit today. I do that both as a care coordinator and as a parent who started off advocating and sitting on mental health quality management committees. I will never give up advocating, and as I work with our youth today who are in wraparound, I know that they have the very same challenges that my son did 10 years ago. So when I talk about what we need, and we need to advocate, and we continue to advocate because we do need understanding of mental health needs in the schools, it's lacking, need of proactive planning. We need to be able to go into the schools. We need to be able to say, as we sit with the IEP committees, or a lot of my kids are just in general ed, that this is what this child needs. You need to be aware. Need to address the barriers for just getting that individual education planning. Communication and relationships. Ongoing stigma, huge. When I worked on a research committee, we came out of the research work with focus groups on kids and parents. Bottom line, schools and stigma are the biggest barrier for our kids asking for help. And you can imagine what that does to the self-esteem. So since my way of advocating is both as a family member, and I always value having a youth's voice at the table, I visited with a youth of mine who last night was put in detention. She had been on the run for, at least 3 weeks. And I visited her this morning before I came. She's had 3 attempts at suicide. Neither one of them obviously have been successful, fortunately. But I told her I was coming here to meet with you guys. And I said, tell me, what would you want them to know? She's got her GED now, very, very bright girl, but she dropped out this fall. She could not handle the environment, the social and emotional piece of the school. And she said, I need them to know that every teacher, not just some teachers, I need them to know that every teacher needs to have background in mental health. And they need to know how those of us who have those challenges present them in the classroom. And I need to be able to use my coping skills when I'm in the classroom. I don't need a teacher to tell me, do you need to leave the room? I don't want to leave the room. So I'm bringing here today another voice of youth that I'd like to introduce. And this is Lara Carranza, and she is with our organization Youth Move here in Oregon, and she's a great advocate for her peers.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gessler, and co-chairs of the committee. For the record, my name is Lara Carranza. Ever since I can remember, I struggled in school. I don't want to get emotional, sorry.
Fine if you do. Okay. You won't be the first person.
But I started, let's start in like middle school, where I was expelled to half days, and I had to be picked up by 11:30. I wasn't allowed to have lunch with my peers. If I wasn't picked up on time, I was confined to a small room where I was staring at a cement wall. By high school, midterm of ninth grade, I was asked to go to the Wainema Alternative High School at Chemeketa. And because of my behaviors and my impulsivity and all of my challenges, struggling to even get an assignment in on time. I couldn't focus during any tests. I couldn't hold a relationship with a friend, a boyfriend, my parents, teachers, counselors, doctors. I actually had to, they asked me to leave the alternative high school. So from there, I was introduced to methamphetamines, where I had, with my impulsivity, I had a very deep, long downward spiral to where I ended up in the juvenile justice system. From there, I was able to go to Hazelden Springbrook. That's an inpatient program where I was finally diagnosed with ADHD, where so many different answers came to light of why I lived such a troubled life, and it was like all these answers to all my chaos. I wasn't the crazy person I thought I was. There was actually a diagnosis behind it now. And at the time, I still didn't have the skills and wasn't ready to change my life. So I continued down the wrong path and ended up in the adult correctional system, where I went to several more treatment centers. And but at that time, I was also able to get connected with Vocational Rehabilitation Services, where they introduced me to an ADHD counselor, where he taught me the life skills that I needed to finally get my life turned around. In 2008, I got clean and sober, and I am now able to work for Youth Move Oregon, where I am a youth partner, and I am able to share my lived experience with the youth and young adults that are still struggling. I have such a passion for Youth Move because it's a resource out there that the young people are allowed to be themselves. They have a safe environment to develop the assets that they need to become leaders in their community. They also are able to highlight their strengths and talents, and we're able to have them speak on committees. But out of all of this, what I would like to just say from it is that I just hope that teachers and counselors and the principals and everybody that sees these young people on a daily basis, if they were able to have some improved training on how to identify early stages of addiction or mental health challenges, that possibly I would have had the opportunity to graduate with my peers and possibly, you know, been able to not have those labels and not have the struggles that I had for as long as I did. So thank you for taking the time to listen to my story.
Thank you for being willing to share your story, and congratulations. You've really accomplished extraordinary things.
Thank you.
We have her on our teams often.
Wait, before you go, are there questions for this panel? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for sharing your story, for sure. And you had mentioned, Jan, need to address barriers. Somewhere in there, you had discussed the two barriers, and you said that the research said school is one of them.
Right.
What does that research specifically say is the mechanism that the school is the barrier?
Well this was these were focus groups, and PSU did research on transition age youth moving into community. And so with both the youth groups and with the family members, we asked them, so what are the barriers that are keeping your kids from going, are getting the help that they need? And I think that because school is an environment, it's not just about learning. It's where our kids grow up. They develop social skills, or they don't develop social skills. And the stigma, I think, just goes along with that. It's very difficult to admit or say to another peer, I'm going to go in the resource room now, and I will be using the resource folks to help me with my organization skills because I probably have a thinking disorder. You know, other kids don't relate to that very well. There's a quick, you know, and adults too. I mean, even some family members are scared to ask for help because maybe their child will be stigmatized. Maybe they will be stigmatized. So we really need to understand that, you know, it's all children. All children who go to school, who all of us have mental health needs, and we need to normalize it. I think that's what those parents and youth were speaking to.
So that was as a result of your focus group,
right,
which is a valuable place to get feedback for sure.
Right.
So really what I heard you saying is it
keeps going back to the stigma. I'm trying to pinpoint that piece that the school has latitude over that we can do something about, that we can impact. And it sounds like it's just that overall theme of stigma,
right,
which is an individual behavior.
I think I can speak for a lot of people. The more we understand about the brain and the neuroscience of what's going on with our kids, when we can see visuals, when we can see magnetic imaging of what's going on, we are educating people. And the more people are educated, I think the more we're going to reduce that stigma. I hope that answers your question.
Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you. And I'm going to introduce Dr. James Sanders and Dr. Whitney Vail.
So which one of you are going to go first? Okay, please begin.
Thank you. Madam Chair, co-chairs, member of the committee, my name is Dr. James Sanders. I am a licensed psychologist here in the state of Oregon. I have a background working in trauma services and neuropsychology at the VA North Chicago. I facilitated running the Adolescent Day Treatment Center at Clackamas County Mental Health and currently sitting on the advisory board for LifeWorks Northwest Adolescent Day Treatment Center. And for the last 9 years, I have consulted with therapeutic educational facilities. Currently, I'm with Lake Oswego School District, where we have developed a series of programs working with kids with significant behavioral challenges and various other mental health disabilities that utilize some of the information that we are presenting here today. Okay. The task that was given to me by our committee was to lay out very briefly some of the fundamental and seminal research pillars that have come out really within the last 10 years and very recently that have changed for, I could say, for all of our committee, our perspective on challenging behaviors. We've known that the brain is a complicated organ. Some of us know it to be the most complicated. 100 billion neurons making connections. It's what we call learning. And many of us have learned that, whether it's in school or elsewhere. At the same time, the research that we're looking at today that comes out of brain-based sciences, trauma-based sciences, neuropsychology, and neurology, right? It points to, although a complicated organ, that it's very predictable in how it develops. So this is Oscar season, so I'd like you to think about that red carpet, and it kind of rolls itself out. And then in your mind's eye, take a line and draw it about a foot, every foot down that carpet. And each one of those segments that you've just created is a new skill, it's an ability, it's a structure in the brain. And if left unhindered, it wants to roll itself out. So it's very predictable in how it develops. The same body of research also shows that it's very susceptible to stress. We can now, through some of through MMRIs and other microscopes, we can now look at neurons as they begin their associations, and we know that in the midst of stress, it just stops. At the same time, there was a study that was conducted called the ACE study, and it's one of those ones that's kind of rocked our world, and you can look at it online. It's called aces.org. It was a co-venture between the Center of Disease Control and Prevention and also Kaiser Permanente. It looked at thousands upon thousands of subjects. And although it's a very large study, there are four things that really come out of it that are germane to what we're talking about today. One is that ACEs, which are considered adverse childhood experiences, those are those stressful situations that we talked about. So that's neglect, that's abuse, that's divorce, it's physical difficulties. That there's a much larger population of kids today that are experiencing adverse childhood experiences than we ever had thought. And that each of them is experiencing a greater number of adverse childhood experiences than we thought. Three, that adverse childhood experiences are directly related to negative outcomes in mental health. And fourth, that they are directly related to negative outcomes in physical health as well. So what does all this mean? Well, this is my part that I get to tell you. This is the bad news. There are a lot of students out there and adults whose brains are not as developed as we thought they were, and that, in fact, we have been asking them and are currently asking them to do things that their brains are not equipped to do. Today, we are looking at challenging behaviors with a new perspective, one that's very similar to the way that we view a learning disability. So Mary, who has a reading disability, when does she have difficulties? When we ask her to read. She doesn't have problems in math. She doesn't have problems in social studies, except for when we ask her to read. And Billy, who has a deficit in social skills, does actually pretty good in the small classroom environment, does actually pretty well at being instructed when it's one or two folks, but seemingly has developed a bad reputation because he gets in a fight every other week when he's at recess playing competitive sports. Right? There are many skills that we've discovered that underlie challenging behaviors. They're those of not just social skills, but executive functioning skills. How do we organize things and problem solve? Language processing skills. How can we use our communication? How can we affect and control our own emotions? And how flexible are we with changes in schedules, whether it's at school or someplace else? All of these are skills that underlie challenging behaviors today. So what we know now is that challenging behaviors occur when the demands of the environment surpass the skill level of an individual. So challenging behaviors are likely to occur when the demands of the environment surpass the skill level of an individual. Ultimately, all of this research has shifted our perspective from one that is really, frankly, mine included, has focused on volition and willful directed behavior, to one that's now more focused on skill deficit, the need to rebuild skills in these students. And in retrospect, in view of all this research, it's no wonder that our past attempts, mine included, that were very sophisticated approaches that use what we call kind of the carrot and stick approach to help motivate students, didn't live up to what we were hoping for the student or for the greater society. So I've painted kind of a bleak picture for you today, but there's good news in the same research, and Dr. Whitney Gale is going to talk about that.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, co-chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Whitney Vale. I'm a licensed psychologist in Oregon, and I currently serve as the treatment director for the Oregon Youth Authority. I have worked with youth in institutional settings for over 15 years, which has included day treatment and therapeutic school programs, as well as psychiatric residential treatment, the Children's State Hospital level of care, and then currently youth corrections. So now that you've heard from Dr. Sanders about why many of the traditional interventions that we use are not effective in achieving what we expect them to, I'd like to give you the good news. So the same research that Dr. Sanders was speaking to shows us that in order for us to access the front of our brains where that executive functioning occurs, which is really the things like thinking before you act and understanding the various consequences of your behavior, the lower part of our brain needs to be clear of distress. So working within the trusting or supporting relationships actually provides that opportunity and allows us to access the front of our brains where we do our best thinking. We've also found through that research that internal motivation, which produces greater accountability and persistence than external motivation does, is driven by a sense of mastery, autonomy, and purpose. Positive trusting relationships support the development of these, and this combination provides a platform for that skill development that Dr. Sanders was speaking about, which is necessary for people to meet the expectations put upon them. So the research also talks about really what works, you know, what works to change people's behavior. And over we found what a lot of people will say, well, we've always known, which is that it's all about relationships. So current research and best practices demonstrate that the most critical aspect of an intervention success is not the style of the intervention, but rather the relationship between the client and the professional. And in fact, this relationship is 7 times more important than the style of intervention. So I would just want to say that again. The relationship between the professional and the client is 7 times more important than the style of the intervention. So I'd like to give you a little personal experience. Last April, I testified to the Ways and Means Committee about a youth that I worked with at the Youth Authority. It was about three years ago when I started working with him. He was 17 when we started working together and turned 18 during the 6 months that we worked together. When I started working with him, he had a number of problem behaviors, including aggression towards others, a lot of issues with self-care. He had suicidal behaviors, and the team tried a number of things, and nothing was effective in working with this youth to change his behavior. He also had not been attending school and had not been working on his education at all. He was really just kind of causing trouble. So as I got to know him and got more information about him, I started a different approach, and his team took on that approach as well. And it was really about understanding him as a human being, as an individual, and getting his perspective on situations. Within the 6 months that we worked together and that his team continued the things that we were working with, he made extreme improvements in his functioning. His personal hygiene improved. He actually completed his GED and got his education. His functioning improved so much, he was no longer harming himself or others, that he was actually ready to parole. Unfortunately, within that time, he had already gained adult charges for some of the previous behavior, and it took that amount of time where his behavior improved for those charges to go through. And ultimately, he ended up with a sentence of 57 months at the Department of Corrections. So I was very fortunate just about a month ago to be able to meet with this youth who is still currently at the Department of Corrections and kind of get an update from him. And as soon as I walked in the door of the facility, I was told that he was up to his old behavior. And the staff at the Department of Corrections didn't know this was his old behavior. They just asked for help. They've been trying for 2.5 years to help him to improve his functioning and his behavior. And so I sat with him, and we just talked, and I got his perspective of what was going on, and I kind of took him back to where he was before and looking at what that difference was. And I got a couple quotes from him reflecting back to his previous experience, and he said, "If you don't get us involved in what we like to do in our lives, our interests, what's the point?" That was one big takeaway. The other was really needing to know who is really there to help you. So within that visit, like I said, I just got his perspective. And there were a lot of things that I thought, you know, he probably shouldn't be doing that, and we probably don't like that. But I never told him to change his behavior or suggested otherwise. 2 weeks post-visit, I got communication from the Department of Corrections that he had requested to speak to his counselor. He was requesting to move to general population and work towards obtaining a job, and he did not want to go to isolation, and he was requesting help in changing how he was doing. 1 month post-visit, he's communicating respectfully and effectively with his counselor and has developed goals for learning to trust his counselor and not give up on himself. He also wants to earn a housing arrangement that he's comfortable with, a job that he enjoys working at. He wants to getting his fines reduced. He wants to move to a different facility and attend and complete a service, class, or group. So this was all on his own decision-making, just kind of thinking about how things could be and trusting people to help him through that process. So just as I learned through working with this youth that it's really about the relationship and it's about getting their perspective on the table, the more information that we've gained through the research over the years has helped us understand, and the major evidence-based approaches are really becoming similar in focusing on 3 main objectives. One is being trauma-informed, one is being person-centered or relational, and the third is being skill-based. So I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Reardon.
I wish we could just talk for hours. one real quick question, Dr. Sanders. I want to make sure, I don't think I understood you correctly, and it's probably me, not what you said, but it was talking about the what's the right word, adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. And could you elaborate just a little bit? It sounded almost like there was a cause-effect and between having a bad experience in your life,
mm-hmm.
and that was almost predictive of what might happen later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect there's way too many variables for it to be that direct a correlation. But could you just clarify that just a little bit?
Sure, I can. And again, I would I'd also direct you to ACEsstudy.org. It's online, and they have several. They have the full publication, and also a few publications that are really bulleted that kind of come down with the most pertinent information that came out of that. And yes, and you are correct that the adverse childhood experiences, as we know, stress arrests the natural tendency of the brain to develop. We know that. The ACEs study comes in really with information about the amount of stressful situations that our youth are experiencing these days, which is significantly higher than we had expected. And yes, it is more of a correlational study. Further research obviously needs to be done to really clarify the magnitude and the effect size that any one particular adverse childhood experience would have on brain development. Did I answer your question?
Kind of one
yeah, follow
okay.
up.
All right. Well, if two people have the same adverse childhood experience,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it be divorce or busted or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or a couple of those things, some may take it in stride, some others have
yes.
poor behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Can you
sure. So if you looked in, I'd point you towards the work of Dr. Bruce Perry that has done really a lion's share of this research. They can now through a clinical interview, if they can get down to very specifically when a particular adverse childhood experience occurred and the intensity of it, and what are those things that are in that individual's life that are offer as a buffer, meaning other positive
yeah.
relationships, right, that does buffer some of that negative energy.
Okay.
With those three things together, they can now put together what they call a brain map that is very indicative of what the brain will look like and what that individual will be good at and what they're not going to be so good at based upon just stressful situations and the buffers, which are the relationships and other positive okay. things in their life.
What was his name again?
Dr. Bruce Perry.
Okay, thank you.
Also online.
Aren't they all?
Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we have Randy Cooper and Brent McLean.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
Chair Gelser, co-chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Cooper, and I'm a behavior specialist for Northwest Regional ESD. I've been a special educator for 14 years. 12 of those years, I spent teaching a self-contained behavior classroom. And the last two, I've been a behavior specialist for the PACE program in Forest Grove. The PACE program is a special school which targets students with severe emotional, social, behavioral, and mental health challenges. A large majority of our students are placed in residential group homes, and for a variety of reasons. All of our students are considered developmentally delayed and have significant issues with aggression, violence, self-injury, social interaction, and academic performance. When I began working at the PACE program 2 years ago, our new administrator enthusiastically began implementing some contemporary and evidence-based practices in hopes to reduce the number of physical restraints, seclusions, and staff injuries. Through the 2012-2013 school year, our staff began utilizing the new techniques taught to them. This was the program's first year of implementation, and the concepts were only being introduced at this point. Through the use of staff development, time, modeling, and coaching, the staff began to see a new perspective in how to manage challenging behaviors. The program strategically scheduled regular time through the school year for staff trainings and used weekly meetings to reinforce the concepts taught to them. In addition to group instruction, coaching and consultation provided individual support to staff while learning these new concepts. As a result, the program saw significant improvement in reducing physical restraints and seclusions. During the 2012-13 school year, the PACE program saw a 31.5% reduction in physical restraints and seclusion compared only to the previous school year. Due to the nature of the program, many students enter and exit regularly. However, there were several students that returned for this school year. Of those returning, there were four particular students who displayed the most challenging and aggressive behavior. They each demonstrated significant reduction in restraints and seclusions. The following data was collected. As you can see, student A, 100% reduction. Student B, 100% reduction. Student C, 94% reduction, and student D, 40% reduction. I believe this data clearly points to the effectiveness of using contemporary research-based practices which focus on relationship building and skill development to greatly improve disruptive and unsafe behavior. I now would like to introduce Brent McLean to represent the perspective of the general ed setting.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, my name is Brent McLean. I am a secondary mathematics teacher and an Oregon recipient of the Presidential Award for Excellence in Math Teaching. I've also served as administratively as a principal and district curriculum director. I represent the general education perspective for our committee. And in my experience, this population, kids who exhibit challenging behaviors or have emotional challenges, is the group of special ed students that really can have the greatest impact on a general education classroom. And at the same time, they also seem to have the fewest supports in a general education classroom. Now, you've heard a few other stories today and some personal stories. I'd like to introduce a student of mine, a former student of mine. We'll call him David. It's April, and the math class has moved down to the computer lab for the day. We're going to be doing our statewide testing in mathematics, and students are at their computers ready to get started. And David is off to the side talking with someone, so I reminded him of what we're doing today and that he needed to stop talking and was ignored. So I reminded him again, and again he kept talking. And so I reminded him a third time, and at that point I got his attention, and he turned to me and said, if you don't shut up, I am going to, expletive deleted, hit you in the face. So this was David. This was the story here. Now, David did not blow up because he wanted to. He was not trying to manipulate me. He was not trying to get something. He was not trying to avoid something. What happened was that he was faced with an expectation that he wasn't ready for. As we heard Dr. Sanders say, he didn't have the skills for this. Perhaps it was because some early childhood trauma had made it so his executive functioning skills, he lacked the ability to tolerate frustration or flexibility or adapting to new situations. But he did not do it because he was mean. So these kids that we're talking about with behavioral and emotional challenges, they are not they're not at fault. The teachers aren't at fault. Parents aren't at fault. It's just the system that we find ourselves in currently that we need to take a good, serious look at. What happens typically in a situation like this is a teacher would just want to remove the child, right? Send him to the principal's office. Send him to the special ed office. Get him out of my room. Whatever it is, right? That's a typical response. And it's understandable, right? There's 36 other kids in the classroom. We're trying to do state testing, and that's something that makes sense you'd want to do. You just want to remove the problem. However, this typical response does not address the real issues. It does not address the issue of helping the student gain the skills that they need in order to handle that or tolerate the frustration or to become flexible. It simply removes them to another location. Perhaps starting in a discipline referral process that is more punitive based, draining the administration resources. So what I would advocate for is that we need to look for a system wide approach to dealing with kids who have these challenging behaviors. And a system that is going to address all aspects of a child's experience at school, whether that be in the general education classroom, the special education classroom, after school activities or sports or transportation, lunchtime, recess, a system-wise approach. We've been, for lack of a better term or use an old term, we've mainstreamed special education students for a long time, and I would say that we've mainstreamed them academically. Well, if we could have an approach that was going to involve all stakeholders, train all the teachers and everything in the same sort of approach and how to deal with these kids, we would also then be mainstreaming these kids with regards to behavioral expectations. So this makes sense from a general ed perspective in that it would not be something that, you know, is defined for one group of students, but it's something that would work for all students, but would be particularly beneficial for those kids with challenging behaviors. And I'd like to introduce Tanya Coker, who's going to talk about early childhood education.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, co-chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tanya Coker, and I'm a program coordinator at Willamette ESD for early intervention and early childhood special education. In the interest of time, I'm going to synopsis most of my statement and kind of point mainly to our research. So we embarked on a research study with OHSU last year. Our staff worked very hard. In fact, I'm not sure they could work any harder, so we had to try something different. So working with OHSU last year, we developed a program using two different research-based methods and are continuing to pilot that out in classrooms and support staff in a different way. And so our preliminary data is showing in our classrooms that kids are, we're having a reduction in challenging behavior, the rate of learning is increasing, we're decreasing our teacher stress, and our parents are feeling more empowered. So we're having the opportunity to change the conversation with very, very young children and their parents and set them up for a whole different way of approaching school in their later years. And we are talking about our most severe young children, so our 0 to 5-year-olds who have severe social-emotional impairment, severe autism. These are the kiddos that we are doing this very, very different model with, and we're finding very, very good results. So, again, due to time, we just have a wrap-up. So Janine Francolini and Stacey Sibley will be coming back.
Thank you very much. Welcome back, Stacey. Welcome, Janine.
Thanks. Madam Chair Gelser, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janine Francolini, and I'm the founder of the Flawless Foundation, which is a nonprofit that works with children with behavioral challenges. I also serve on the Sachs Institute for Mental Health Law, Policy, and Ethics at the U.S. Gould School of Law, and I'm a regular contributor to the Huffington Post on mental health and education. And on a personal note, while I did well academically in school, I was one of the children that we're talking about today. So I'm just going to wrap up here with a few questions for us to ponder together. The first one is, why are our prisons our largest institutions for psychiatric care? Why do we even have the idea? Why does the idea of the school-to-prison pipeline even exist? And how can it even be possible that I got a call a few weeks ago from a parent in an emergency room because their 4-year-old child was escorted to the hospital by the police because of difficult behavior in his kindergarten classroom? I am involved in the national conversation on these issues, and Oregon over and over again is a shining light in leadership in very progressive ways of working with children in many systems of care. And we are here today to bring that leadership to the realm of education in the state. And I'm going to end with another miraculous story, similar to Bobby. Ellen Sachs is a legal scholar who was awarded a genius award by the MacArthur Foundation, and she has been living with schizophrenia for 31 years and has talked about how education and work have saved her life. And she refers to this quote by Freud that's up there, love and work, work and love, that's all there is. So we would like to come together and create environments where our kids can be productive can be seen through the lens of promise and hope and can feel cared about. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I just want to wrap up by saying thank you. I know we took a lot of your time today, and we really appreciate you listening about our students. I think you heard two things today, that relationship and skill building is probably the most important thing we do for these kids. And while everybody here talked about it, it's not happening in our state consistently for this population. So anything we can do to help, we'd be glad to do it. And thank you again.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, as I mentioned before, I think this is a really important topic to tackle moving forward, both as we're looking at our school funding task force. Part of what we heard is many of these students who are struggling are not identified as special education or any other kind of category that brings additional funding, although the resources that schools need to provide in order to keep these students both safe in school and also learning and progressing towards a high school diploma are significant. So I think we have some funding formula questions to talk about, some professional development issues to look at, and I'm hoping that we can pull a couple of legislators together in an informal work group kind of way to work with the professional committee in terms of looking at any recommendations that might come back in February. So we will reset this on the agenda for a future hearing in the interim, and would be interested in hearing from any of you after the hearing that might be interested in being part of that work group and taking some leadership on this issue moving to the 2015 session in the House, for those of you that will be in the House in 2015. Any further comments or questions before we complete this information?
You don't have time, really, do you?
Not really, but but I invited.
Okay, you did. So what percentage of the school population are we talking about? And you started the whole presentation with slides on how many shootings there had been. What percentage do we know of people that committed the shootings were involved in these programs or maybe should have been involved in the programs? So,
I don't have that exact information in front of me, but what I will say that if they're not in special education and they're feeling desperate enough to commit school shootings, they should have some mental health or special ed services, and maybe we're not identified. The students we're talking about in Oregon in special ed, there's some data in the books that we gave you that shows the kids who are identified emotionally disturbed and other health impaired, and those are typically the students we're talking about today, as well as the students who are still not identified because they do well academically, like Janine talked about, but still have the social emotional issues.
Yeah, so identification is so key.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you all. I know you put a lot of work into putting the presentation together. Thank you all so much for coming. Right. And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on students with significant behavior needs. And I'm going to open a public hearing on a non-controversial bill, Senate Bill 1538, where we're all going to have a big kumbaya moment because we all agree on everything in this bill. Richard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 1538A allows school district boards to place limitations on proposals for public charter schools that boards will evaluate if a specific percentage of schools of the district are enrolled in students in the school district are enrolled in public charter schools, and a specified number of public charter schools are located in the school district. It allows public charter schools to give priority for admissions to specified students and declares an emergency effective on passage. The committee has been asked to consider the -A8 amendments, which would remove the option in the measuring and gross measure as is to allow charter schools to give priority for admissions to students who have historically been underserved due to race, ethnicity, low-income status, or English language learner status.
And colleagues, we'll get to that -8 a little bit later, but I would also point to in the stack, we have a letter from the Legislative Council indicating that the language that we would be taking out of the bill violates both the Equal Protection Clause, the United States Constitution, and the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Oregon Constitution, and therefore it could be problematic to move that out of the committee. So, David Williams. And Kristen Miles.
Thank you, Chair Gelson, members of the committee. David Williams with Portland Public Schools. You have before you today a a very fine piece of public policy that has been fairly vetted with the body, and you may recognize this. This is essentially a redraft of a piece of legislation we had from the 2013 legislative session, which came out of your committee and was approved by the House last session. We began this bill in the Senate this time. We had fallen just short of that body last legislative session. It came out of the Senate on a 17-13 vote, coming over your way with some additions as spoke to. I'm going to have my director of charter schools, Krista Miles, run through what the bill does, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Kristen Miles, and I'm the director of charter schools for Portland Public Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about Senate Bill 1538A. The objective of this bill is to allow districts who are already well-versed in charter school sponsorship the ability to focus their incoming applications to their stated student achievement goals. Its purpose is not to limit charter applications, but to create an additional avenue for serving the greatest needs of the district through the innovation of charter schools. Currently, districts must evaluate each charter school application it receives on its own merits. That is, if a charter school application meets the criteria stated in ORS 338, the board should approve the application, regardless of how many other qualified applications it receives that year, regardless of whether or not the application meets the current educational goals and objectives of the district. Senate Bill 1538A would do the following. It would allow a district having more than 3% of its students enrolled in brick-and-mortar charter schools located in the district and three or more brick-and-mortar charter schools sponsored by the district to amend its application process to consider only proposals that intentionally address one or more school board-adopted educational goals. In other words, a district with 3% or more of its students in charter schools and three or more charter schools would have the option to create an alternative application process whereby the district would only be obligated to review charter school applications that aligned with the district's stated educational goals. School district boards would set these goals biennially, but review them annually, and would be required to submit these goals to the State Board of Ed. The district would then be allowed to rank applications not only on their own merits, but against each other, so that, for example, a district receiving 4 applications a year, as PPS generally does, might decide to approve only the top 1 or 2 at its discretion. Any stated and publicized district educational goal that a charter school or charter applicant seeks to address would be an element of the charter school application, and progress toward advancement of the school would also be a factor in future charter renewals if the charter application were approved. While this alternative process could only be implemented in a case where a district has more than 3% of its students in brick-and-mortar charter schools and sponsors 3 or more brick-and-mortar charter schools, it would not be mandatory. That is, nothing in this bill would prevent a qualifying district from choosing not to opt into this model. Senate Bill 1538A does not, however, allow districts to opt out of reviewing any new charter school applications or allow them to set unattainable goals in order to discourage applications altogether. The intent is to increase local control by simply using one of the most flexible and innovative school models we now have to serve our students' greatest needs. Each school district knows best what these needs are and should be afforded the flexibility to be just as innovative in serving them. The new process would not affect existing charter schools, nor will it impact them when they come up for renewal. Additionally, should a district's charter school enrollment fall below the 3% threshold in any given year, or should the district sponsor fewer than 3 charter schools in any given year, that district would default back to the current charter application process for each year that it did not meet the criteria. Thank you for your time, and as David said, we'll answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for coming here and discussing this today, an important issue, and I know a lot of us have strong feelings about charter schools. I'd ask you, Kristen, what – this isn't a test, so I'm not asking for the whole vision, mission statement thing, but what are a couple of the stated goals and objectives for Portland Public Schools currently?
So we haven't adopted those four charter schools, but one of the things that we are trying to do better at is, for example, graduate more students of color or serve ESL populations better. We have certain milestones that we've adopted, graduating more kids on time, ready to read by third grade. Those kinds of things are in our strategic plan.
So I heard you say you haven't adopted those yet for charter schools. So you anticipate two standards, one for the schools you already have in the district and the charter schools. Is that correct?
Two different standards?
You said you haven't adopted the standards for charter schools yet.
As far as looking at applications mm-hmm. under those mm-hmm. goals, so we don't anticipate setting any additional goals, but that we could use this process to further those goals that have already been set.
So is that a process that you're going to use currently with your schools? It feels to me like we're setting up two standards, one for charter schools. And certainly, based on history in some districts in this state, those can be harder set to be higher for a charter school than the rest of the schools in the district, and they're all public schools. So my concern is that we're setting up two standards, and we're going to hold charter schools and not renew charters if perhaps they don't meet those standards, but other schools, we're not going to have that same level of discussion.
So, Representative Gelser, Representative Springer, I think it's an excellent point. Obviously, we haven't established goals for charter school applications because we can't under current law. So we are not able to focus applications on specific academic goals that the district wants to achieve. I don't think what we're talking about is necessarily standards. I think what we're talking about is, so we do have goals for our bricks and our traditional schools in the system. We have a milestones framework that we target resources and expect schools to achieve. But we don't have an ability to extend that milestones framework to the applications that we're seeing come to the district in the form of charter schools. So we, for instance, can be getting applications that really don't help further any of the greatest needs of the school district that we know that our board identifies exist. We can't focus those applications that come to us. And that really is the intent of this bill, is to say the school board have a robust conversation around what are the greatest needs of the district, which they do every year when they establish our milestones framework. But let's be able to extend that to new applications that are being brought forward to the district to say, here are the milestones pieces that we really want charter school applications to address. We really need this year, we want charter school applications to address third grade reading. That is a key milestone of the district, and we want to focus applications on that greatest need that we see in the district. That's really what this is about, being able to extend that to charter school applications.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. So are there currently I have been a part of charter school, the charter conversation with a potential charter school. And so in those conversations, I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, that there has been conversation around the idea of what the district wants to see as outcomes for the entire district and how charter schools add to that or take away from that. And so my guess is there's some level of that conversation that is already existing within your school district and potential applicants.
Chair Gelson, Representative Springer. So while the conversation could exist, and while we as a district put on our application that we are particularly interested in applicants that help serve our students with greatest needs, we're unable to do anything about either saying that we are going to accept only those applications that do meet our targeted goals or to rank them against each other, which this bill would also allow us to do.
May I have one more?
Yes,
thank you.
Of course, Madam Chair. So, your school district, Portland Public, I'm not asking about any other districts. You mentioned as far as when I asked what the goals and objectives were, you said that you'd graduate more students and the kids would be more successful and those kinds of things. If we can narrow that down to a couple things a little bit, how are the charter schools in your district, even the ones that are sponsored by ODE, how are the charter schools in your district comparing to the district average in, let's say, Smokes test scores or that graduation rate? Are they below or above your district average?
Chair Gelson, Representative Springer. It depends on the school. Some outperform and some don't perform as well. So it's hard to create an average, and that's it's hard to do that on a national scale as well. But so, like I said, some perform better than their district counterparts, and some don't perform as well.
Thank you. That's like we have in all our districts. Some of our schools perform a little better than others. Thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair.
You're most welcome. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. And, Madam Chair, I've got a few questions, so if you'll indulge me.
We're ready.
Thank you. Well, welcome back on this topic. So, several questions. Of course, I didn't support the bill the first time. I'm curious how this bill is different this time, other than the piece that may or may not get amended out that the chair spoke to. So, if a charter school doesn't meet the current educational goals of the district, I mean, is it your intent to immediately deny that charter?
So, Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish, a couple of pieces there. One, how is this bill different than the one you had last session? There are a couple of key differences. One, the bill that you approved last session did not allow, under this process, if a district was opting into it, would not have allowed charter school applicants to appeal the decision of the board to the State Board of Ed. That section, which was a non-appealable language, has been removed. So, under this provision, charter school applicants would be able to appeal the decision of a local board. So, for instance, an applicant comes, they believe they attempt to address the goal stated by the board. The board says, no, you're not addressing our goal. They would then have a right to take that to the State Board of Ed. And actually, courtesy of House Bill 2150 that you passed last session, there's a second level of appeals contained at the what's called the completeness stage. So when somebody brings an application to a district, the first thing we do is review for completeness, whether you've checked off all the items, before we review for quality. And they would be able to appeal that that completeness decision as well. So there's actually two appeals built into the system. The second change to this bill, again, other than the amendment added in the Senate, is that the bill, in triggering whether or not a district can get into this process, you have to have 3% or more of your kids in charter schools and 3 or more charter schools. We've added language that excludes virtual charter schools from both of those counts. So this is merely whether or not a school district can get into this. So if you remember last session, there were about 8 or 9 school districts that would have been able to get into this process. That small change drops that list down to, I believe, about 6. Some key ones that drop off the list, for instance, are North Bend and Gresham Barlow, which no longer have 3 bricks and mortar charter schools. They have 2 bricks and mortar and a virtual charter school as well. To your question about whether or not we'd be immediately denying, obviously, first of all, there's a timeline issue. This bill would not be effective until January 1, 2015 for this portion of the bill. So you were really looking at the 2015-16 cycle of charter school applications. And I think the question of denial really is a cart before the horse. It would depend on who is bringing applications to the district and whether or not they are addressing a goal. I think our intent, obviously, is if this bill were to pass, our board would immediately have that conversation around what academic goals they do want charter school applications to address, and would really signal that to the community that that's what we're looking to accomplish. And we certainly believe that our community in Portland, being robust in the nature that it is, would bring applications that do attempt to address those goals. And that is absolutely what we would see.
So, want to follow up? So, under this current bill and with the existing charter school applications that you have right now, how many of them do not fit the criteria of your board goals that would be ones that you would likely toss out?
So, Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish, again, the board, I don't know what goals the board would adopt, so I really couldn't speculate on that. If there's one thing I've learned in my years is try not to get too far ahead of your board when it comes to board decisions. So I can't say. We do have, we will, beginning in the fall, have 11 operating charter schools in the district. This has absolutely no bearing on their operations. We want them all to be successful in their endeavors, and we try to work with them to the greatest extent possible to make sure that they are successful in the district, and it won't affect them upon renewal either. So really, the question of whether or not the board adopted goals would apply to those charter schools is really a moot point, because we wouldn't even begin to go back and review them in alignment with that, because that's not, those charter schools were sponsored and adopted in a different era, and again, as the bill would allow,
school boards could alter their board adopted goals on a biennial cycle. So that's going to change over time about what are the greatest needs of the district to really try to get at those needs and really try to attract the kind of charter schools that will really help districts close some of their biggest gaps.
So I'm going to go back to something that you said about the being new in the bill, where now districts could go to the state board to have an appeals process. Does that include the multiple authorizers process?
Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish, yes.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Since we last visited on this bill, I asked the question, so I'll ask it again. Do you have district-sponsored and operated charters, or have you made a move to try to start any of those that would be in line with potentially the current board goals for some of your schools that, your public school system now?
Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish, no, we do not.
Okay. Follow up. Let me see where I've not added my notes in my list. I just have a few more, I promise. I lost my spot. So I want to go to the intent of the 1999 charter law, which really is about having a groundswell of parents come to a school district and say that they have an idea, whether it fits your board goals or not. Then Governor John Kitzhaber signed that into law, giving that as an opportunity for parents to address when the schools aren't meeting their needs. So kind of a two-parter. How many of the schools that are currently in your purview, not your charter schools, but your schools that you're operating, and you have board goals for them, how many of those are actually meeting those goals right now in the system that you currently have? And I'm just kind of curious about what your thoughts are on flipping the intent of that charter law to change the direction of this and say that it should be a school board that has the purview of what is the needs of the parents, when the whole point of that law was to let parents come to the school board and say, this is what we want.
Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish, excellent questions. Obviously, we have a goal of, as the state's stated goal, is 100% graduation rate. None of our schools are meeting 100% graduation rate. When it comes to the intent of the 99 charter school law, I didn't help write that law. I wasn't here. I'm sure there are many people who can speak to that. When it comes to what we're trying to accomplish here, I think it's fair to say that we are a long ways from 99, and we are in... We believe that what the bill does is allow districts that have a fairly robust system of charter schools operating in their district. As I mentioned, we will have 11 operating charter schools and about 4% or more of our kids attending charter schools starting this fall. It allows, after you've had that that organic development, it allows you to bring greater focus to charter school applications that are being brought before the district. It allows the board to say, okay, we've got that kind of broad choice inherent in the system. We want to be able to say, to that parent community, to that business community, to whatever interests are bringing charter school applications, we want to be able to signal to them, these are the greatest needs in the district. And these are the issues we want addressed. For all of our institutional criticisms for things like No Child Left Behind, one of the things that one of its strengths, one of the things that it did do is it did shine a big ray of light on data and on the need to really drill down and find out what the greatest needs of the districts are. Often we can be masked by the law of averages, and we really we've come to a new environment of being able to identify what are the greatest needs in the district, and we want to be able to focus all of our resources, not just the resources in our traditional schools, which we do, which our board struggles with every day and every year as they identify their goals, and they identify things like enrollment caps and where we want our neighborhood schools to be and what programs are in them versus our choice options and other options in the district. We want to be able to bring that same focus and conversation to new charter school applications coming to the district once we've moved beyond that initial organic creation.
Last question. In your board process, as you create this second tier of standards that are outside of the standards of your public schools, how do you bring in the parent voice into helping to design those standards? What is your plan for that? Because I do have very real concerns that if it's up to your school board, that this is a very limiting bill. This is designed to limit the choices of families who are not happy with Portland Public Schools. The graduation rates are not attractive to any prospective family who wants to move into Portland. And I appreciate all of the challenges that you've got in your district. All districts have some kind of challenges. But I'm really just curious how you rope families into this when it's very clear that this bill feels to me like something that is designed to cut families out.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Representative Parrish, I do want to be clear what we're allowing districts to do is to create academic goals, which are very inherently different than standards. So I think that's an important distinction. When it comes to process, I think it's sometimes a running joke, but sometimes a reality that Portland is nothing if not a city about process. And I think you all, more than anybody, appreciate the value of elected governance. And you know that we have a board that is elected by the citizens of the Portland Public Schools to represent them in the governance and operation of the district, and we feel supremely confident in our elected board's ability to represent their constituents.
And Mr. Williams, we have an initiative process for when this body doesn't get its job done, that the citizens have an alternative method to get the people's work finished. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Madam Chair, you said we're going to talk about the LC. Can I use that in a question to the Portland School?
Of course.
Okay. Mr. Williams, you know, this bill went through the Senate, with the amendment, which legislative council has now said may be unconstitutional state and nationally. Do you oppose that concept, and if that concept could be changed, the wording of that to be unconstitutional, would the Portland school system support, make an exception for that group of our citizens, which are suffering,
right,
and I think deserve a special consideration. We've seen it in the Washington, D.C. and other areas where we really do need that group needs help.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Gelser. Representative Wisnett, I think we absolutely support the goals that the proponents of that language want to bring about, the goal of targeting services to students who maybe have had a harder time in the system than others, to, frankly, where the data shows us we have our biggest achievement gaps. I think the Legislative Council opinion obviously draws to question this specific language, and we have pledged to the proponents that we're happy to work with them throughout the interim to find appropriate language. I think we can all agree that when dealing with these types of issues and the issues of race, that there are a lot of compounding factors, and we want to make sure that we get right, so that this is not something that is open for abuse for the wrong reasons, so that people can use it for the right reasons about targeting services.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If in this short session there would be an opportunity to have a conference committee set up to work this and still get it done this session, is that not possible?
And we can talk about this a little bit more later. I think I've shared with David Williams, we worked very hard last session to pass House Bill 2747, which was very specific about not making admissions decisions based upon the personal characteristics of students. There are a lot of ways to target services to students, the primary one being recruitment. Even if you are prioritizing in a lottery, if you have not recruited students to come in and fill out the application and go through the process of getting into the system, it doesn't matter whether you have a preference or not. They're not there in your lottery to get there. So there are a variety of ways to get that done, but language that either directly says we're going to have race-based admissions, or language that tries to get around overtly saying that so it can happen, is something that I'm very, very uncomfortable with the constitutionality of and would have a very difficult time supporting.
If it is possible.
Sure. Representative Parrish.
Madam Chair, my question is actually to you. I appreciate the constitutional question, and I appreciate that we have legislative counsel who helps us craft that. But if we passed a bill that had a constitutional question, wouldn't it be for our state Supreme Court to make that determination, not our legislative counsel?
Representative Parrish, absolutely. But I know, speaking only for myself, that when I took my oath, I said I would uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Oregon, which would make it very difficult for me to ever cast a vote or hold a work session on something that I believed violated the Constitution of the United States or the Constitution of the State of Oregon. So that's an impediment in the process to getting there. Others might make
a different judgment, but our attorneys have told us quite clearly that they believe it violates both the state and federal constitution, and it would be a violation of my oath to, if I believe them, to support language that did that. Any further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. Representative Frederick is in the back. Representative Frederick?
Hello, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. I'm going to be brief, I hope. I try to be brief, and I hope gentle to some extent, because I have to say that regarding the Dash 6 amendment that's been incorporated into this particular bill, I want to make it very clear that I support. I need to introduce myself. I'm Lou Fredericks, State Representative for District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I happen to really applaud and support the particular charter school that suggested this particular concept. However, I do have some serious reservations about it. You've mentioned a few of them, especially concerned about the legal and constitutional issues. The Dexter's comments were very, very clear. He considered it very likely a violation of both the federal and the state constitutions. I think that's very, very likely the case as well. I don't want to, more than that, I don't want to have a bill that, a law that ends up in the courts on constitutional grounds, especially since we've already had some things litigated regarding this particular issue. So I am concerned about that. I do, however, want to make sure that we are thinking about how we work together to really address some of these students and this particular approach that this charter school has been working on already. They've been doing a good job. We need to find some way to help them and support them. I just don't want to have some unintended consequences that I think are actually not so mysterious in terms of what might take place. And frankly, this is a significant policy decision that I think should be vetted in a long session. It should not be something that's done very quickly. We need adequate time to look at research and to amend it and deliberate. And so, in my view, the short session is the wrong place for this particular part of the bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Frederick? Then thank you very much.
And I wanted to, at some point, you already done 1574, is that right?
We already did 1574.
Okay.
And we're
I will
not
talk with you later about it then.
All right, I'll look forward to it. Thank you very much, and thanks for being patient back there.
Sure.
Before we called you. All right, Karn Hikas and Rosalind Williams. Rashad Williams, sorry. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair excuse me, need more cough drops. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Karin Hikas. I think most of you know that I've been representing most of the charter schools in the state for about the past 10 years, and also want to say that I am a mother of three children, two of whom we just have recently adopted through DHS, so I just have to say that the informational session it resonated with me a great deal. Because one of the daughters that we adopted was a little bit older when we got her. And at any rate, Bruce Perry, Dan Siegel, a lot of the folks that they referenced in their presentation are folks that I have come across in my desperate research over the last year or so. So that was good to hear, trying to switch gears to charter schools. But I am passionate about this work because I'm a career public educator. I'm passionate about charter schools because I believe that they can provide, amongst many other options, high-quality options within the public school system. I'm not going to talk a lot about the core base of the bill because you've heard a lot about that. The charter schools that I work with don't love the base bill, I will say that, but we definitely appreciate all of the work that's been done on it between last session and now to take out some of the more harmful pieces. We really tried to stay neutral on this bill in the spirit of collaboration, and also because of the piece we were able to add on the Senate side, which you were just speaking about. So I'd like to talk about that piece primarily. I should also say that I am with Kairos PDX, which is the charter school that Representative Fredericks referenced. I'm one of the four co-founders of that nonprofit in North Portland that exists to close the racial achievement gap in North Portland. And we will be opening our K-5 charter school this fall. We also will be doing at least one preschool and early learning network, which we already are doing. So that's really our passion. A lot of charter schools have wanted to do something like this for a while in terms of being able to give some priority in admission to students that are more disadvantaged. There's a lot of different ways to say it. You know, other states do this and other initiatives do this, and they say things like at risk of academic failure or disadvantaged or, you know, or specify, you know, particular groups of people. Charter schools are often criticized for not serving a diverse enough demographic, and that's a complicated issue and certainly does have to do with some outreach and marketing and authentic relationships with different communities, different groups, but also has to do with the fact that charter schools don't get transportation funding and get significantly less per pupil funding than district schools do, and so it's hard for students in non-dominant culture, non-dominant groups to have the same access to charter schools as those who are in the dominant culture. So we were really happy. I talked with David Williams during the interim. I've talked with a number of PPS board members, and they've expressed support for this concept. And so he was kind enough to let us put it in his bill this session, and we worked with all of the members of the Senate Education Committee to put it in. The goal is to allow charter schools to give priority admission to a certain number of kids who have been historically underserved, not just by the public school system, but by everybody. So it's not a criticism of the public school system per se. In terms of the
And, Karen, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize pretty soon.
Yeah,
we've got about
10
more people in about 10 more minutes.
I understand. So let me just get straight to the piece of the legal opinion that came out yesterday. I'm not a lawyer. I've been accused of being one. I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing. But I've talked to a few in the last 24 hours, and we all know good lawyers disagree all the time, and this is a complicated issue. What I will draw your attention to is a brief written by the U.S. Department of Justice and U.S. Department of Education, specifically on guidance on how districts can achieve racial balance and SES balance and gender balance in their schools. This is something that is allowable and is done. So I'm not sure about the constitutional piece. We've worked on the language all session. We're not married to the language. We are committed to the concept, and we've worked on language. We're happy to continue to work on language. Portland is my district, so I looked on the PPS website, and I see that even PPS uses SES and native language speaking and a variety of other factors to give weight within their internal enrollment process. So I don't know.
That's not allowed anymore after House Bill 2747.
Yeah, I found it this morning online, so I don't know. And ELL programs, dual language immersion programs that are run by districts give priority admission to native, you know, whoever, if it's native Spanish speakers. We have a charter school in Ontario that cannot do that. They're a dual language program. They cannot give priority to native Spanish speakers, and that really causes challenges for them, for all their kids. And I believe you have a letter from them in your record for today. That's Four Rivers Charter School. So at any rate, I'm not sure that the legalities are cut and dry, but we are committed to the concept, and we hope that you will work with us on that. Over the interim, especially if you take this piece out completely rather than taking time to work on it now. We hope we can work on that because we really do want to make it easier for kids who are underserved to have true access to public charter schools. That's it. Unless you have questions, I'll turn it over to Rashad.
Welcome, Rashad.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chuck Gessler and members of the committee. I'm here to speak on behalf. My name is Rashad Williams, for the record, and I'm speaking on behalf of Kairos PDX, and also as a father of a 3-year-old who's going to be school age in a couple years here. And
I really want to just really talk about and state some of the facts of Portland Public Schools and where we've been, specifically towards students of color. Portland Public Schools, the racial achievement gap has been prolific for about 50 years, and we believe in part because we haven't authentically engaged the communities of color to be really a part of that solution. And Kairos PDX, as Karin said earlier, recently was approved by Portland Public Schools. And we believe we can directly address this gap. If you don't know, the word kairos is an ancient Greek word. And the word means the right or opportune time, or that supreme moment. And we really believe, really focusing on K through 5 is that supreme moment. We know that students, are for most part in our lives, we get one chance at things. We get one great opportunity. One great opportunity at education, and we really want to focus on that. Unfortunately, in Portland, race is a greater predictor than class of academic achievement in Portland, and that's an unfortunate fact there. But right now, what do we also know? That children of color are 3 to 4 times likely to be kicked out of school for subjective reasons in Portland. And another staggering fact that I found here is only 12% of African-American and 6% of Latino students living in North Portland are on track to graduate, according to third grade test scores now. So we all know this is a huge problem that we need to address. And look, and I'll be short, all this isn't new. I mean, it's been going on for way too long. It's been about 5 decades or so that this has been going on. So really what we want to do is we know also within charter schools that are within PPS, schools that yield the greatest results for children of color right now are alternative schools and charter schools. We heard earlier that there are some variances, but overall that's what we found, that that special attention to these students of color have been beneficial for them. And a great example of this, and I'm sure PPS would acknowledge this, is SEI Academy, which has been a strong example of this, and it's a model school for this year, and also Arthur Academy. And it has a completely different educational model than SEI. So different various curriculum and tactics go a long way within that community. And lastly, what we do know, these students of color who we've been talking about traditionally within Portland Public Schools do not and have not been served well. And denying unrepresented youth access to these schools is denying children access to opportunity and causing us to fall short of our 40-40-20 vision before kids even hit sixth grade. So over 40% of children in PPS are children of color. So we're talking close to 50%. So figuring this out is essential. And it is close to the majority of their students. So lastly, and it takes a village, we know, to raise kids and to really create a new environment. And it all takes us working together to really solve this incestuous problem that's been going on, again, for over 5 decades. So I don't want to be too long, but I really feel like passionate about this work, that in one generation we can change the cycle of poverty for a child. So again, this isn't conjecture. It's a great possibility if we all work together. So thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And really briefly,
so you're with the charter school.
Yes.
Are you in that capacity as a parent, as a charter board sponsor?
I'm on staff,
a teacher?
And a parent, yes.
Are you a teacher?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
No, I do infrastructure organization, setting up the charter school from operations from that capacity.
Great, thank you.
Yep.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
So we're almost out of time, but I did see legislative counsel is here. So Dexter and Hannah, people have questions about the opinion. And I think we're going to have to carry this over to Friday. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. And we heard that we were wanted, but don't really kind of guess why, but we don't know exactly what the question is.
We were having a discussion about your about the opinion, about kind of preferences in admission based on race or socioeconomic status.
Yeah, and well, to summarize the opinion, essentially, we concluded that it is likely a court would find that the 1538-A, the amendment, the provision dealing with giving priority for admission based on historically underserved populations due to race, ethnicity, students in low-income households, or English language learner students would be problematic, and specifically as regards to giving priority based on race or ethnicity. The federal courts have concluded that particularly that both in a higher ed context where there's a lot more litigation, but also in the K through 12 context, that having that while it is okay to consider race or ethnicity as part of a as factors among many in making admissions decisions, it is in fact a violation of the Equal Protection Clause to have race be kind of the primary factor considered, and the way we look at this language, that in fact would be the case in the context of public charter schools where they serve a specific geographic area, and under the provisions of this, priority for admission must be given if in fact the applicant is in a race or ethnicity that has historically been underserved.
Questions for Council Representative Parrish?
Thank you. So the federal constitutional question aside for a moment, if this body said we want to do that and it would require us to change our state constitution to do that, would that be a 40 vote if this came to the floor to do that, to have that change, or would it have to go out to the people to change that? Because our constitution, I appreciate Chair's, you know, piece about wanting to pull the constitution, and that's, I'd like to do the same thing, but our constitution does change and there is a process for that. So I'm curious what your thoughts are if this body really wanted to do this and raise the question and change the constitution so we could allow that. Yeah. What does that process look like?
Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish, actually the Legislative Assembly itself cannot directly change the constitution. Any constitutional amendment proposed by the legislature must be in the form of a joint resolution, and it's actually the people that decide one way or the other whether the constitution can be is to be amended that way. You mentioned whether there was a supermajority vote required, and I would say in this context the answer is no. It's a simple majority vote in the Legislative Assembly. There is, if the changes are such that they're more appropriately characterized as a revision, that does require a two-thirds vote in this chamber before it goes to the people.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dexter, is the underlying premise of the goal illegal, or is there some wordsmithing that could be done to make it work? Still accomplish the goal, but do it in a way that's legal.
Yeah. Chair Gelser and Representative Hoffman, that's a great question, and I think in theory, you could have a school district, and it would really be up to the public charter school to be able to thread the needle in such a way that perhaps race is merely one factor of many in the district or the public charter school promoting a goal of a diverse student body, not merely racially diverse, but diverse from, you know, multiple backgrounds, multiple socioeconomic groupings and other factors. In theory, that's possible. This language does not do that because it has race or ethnicity as a single factor. So the language would have to be modified. But beyond that, it would be could only be one of many factors that are considered. The problem, this works at the higher ed level. I really don't think it would work at the state level because, as I understand it, and Hannah can correct me, but as I understand it, for public charter schools, they serve a specific geographic area, and it's not unlike higher ed, there isn't a consideration of academic qualifications. Is that accurate? Yeah. And so while in theory it is possible, I think as a practical matter, it is not possible at this level. And then the following, even if it were possible at the federal level, I think it would be unlikely that it would pass state constitutional muster either. You could, of course, propose an amendment to that.
Thank you.
Representative Fagan.
Mostly just a comment, and so there's this, but it's correct that even if it were to amend our state constitution, your opinion is that it violates the federal constitution. So we can't have a state constitution. It would be null and void if it violates the federal constitution either way, even if we amended our state constitution.
That's correct.
Correct. So, and there's, and just as, mostly as a comment because of an earlier comment, some legislators believe that, you know, legislature should just pass policy and leave the constitutional questions to the courts. And I, for one, appreciate when you opine on issues of constitutionality because, as the chair mentioned, I don't think that that's the appropriate measure. In particular, when you mentioned the 14th Amendment, if you look at the text of it, it says no state shall make any law that, you know, denies the equal protection of the laws. So I do believe, you know, as the branch that makes laws, it is our duty to consider and take seriously constitutional issues and to not pass policy that we do believe has, you know, that violates the Constitution, because the Constitution itself says that no state shall make any law. It doesn't just say that we can't enforce those laws. It says that we shouldn't make them. So that's mostly just a comment to a prior conversation before you were in here. So,
thank you. Any further questions for counsel? Thank you both very, very much. So we're going to carry over the public hearing and the work session on this bill to Friday. All right, and with that, thank you all for sticking around. Representative Gomberg, do you have a motion?
I do. I apologize for being out of the room testifying in another committee when we voted on 1574A. I would respectfully request unanimous consent the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting aye on the motion on Senate Bill 1574A. With a due pass recommendation, it would not change the outcome of the vote taken.
All right, so I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1574A. And Representative Gomberg requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded. No, to allow Representative Gomberg to be recorded as voting aye. Move Senate Bill 1574A with due pass recommendation. It will not change the outcome of the vote. Is there any objection? If there is no objection, so ordered. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1574A, and we're adjourned.
I would not be as busy.
I mean, if you can't be here.
I mean, if you can't be here.